from their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What an incredible podcast with an incredible human being. Robert Greene, author of The 48 Laws of Power, has just released a special edition of The 48 Laws of Power. It's a book unlike any I've seen before. First, the design of the book is, it's like a living sculpture. And of course, if any of you have read The 48 Laws of Power, I'd encourage you to reread it. There's thousands of stories in there. It's like the history of the world through the eyes of someone learning about power and persuasion and seduction and war and stories from all over the world, all over history. It's such an incredibly deep book. I've probably read it more than a dozen times. And Robert and I have a great discussion about it. And also, we start off with him giving me advice on my next book. And so that was very interesting. You know, Robert Greene is one of my heroes as a writer, and for him to listen to him give me advice on writing is really wonderful as well. So hope you enjoy this conversation. And here's Robert Greene, author of the special edition also of the 48 Laws of Power, just released, 25th anniversary edition.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Playing tournament chess, where I was a chess master, after the 25-year break, I was starting again, and my goal was, as an older person in my 50s now, trying to reach the level that I was at before. And it's been a fascinating experience. It's been unbelievable, the adventures.
I want to hear about it. I'd like to talk about it. You know, I think it's something I can explore, as we talked about last time, through the lens of my book, Mastery. You know, I'd love to hear more about it. So let's definitely talk about that.
I mean, I definitely reviewed your book, Mastery, as well. And a lot of it did make me think of your book, because just engaging in the idea of a quest has put me on this path to adventure. Whether or not I succeed in the quest is still unknown, but I've kind of improved as a person in the pursuit of this, you know, far off goal. So it's been very interesting.
Well, I think just doing it, you've already succeeded. So I don't think you have to gauge that or measure it by whether you become a grandmaster or whatever the stages are. It's more the fact that you're doing it, that you're taking this journey, you know, whatever, I don't like that word, but you're doing that. It's already successful. It's already something that's going to bring a lot of meaning to your life and teach you a lot. So I don't think there's any metric that you need to use to decide whether it's been successful or not.
That's interesting. I've been grappling with this because I feel like people won't be interested unless I achieve the goal. But maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know.
What people are you talking about?
Well, that's a good question too. I think my audience would in part be older people who want to return to something they love and pursue it, even when everyone tells them it's impossible. And another audience would be improving chess players. And so that's the audience I don't think I can, well, but maybe that's not true, because I have so many. I mean, I've had dinner with the world champion in Norway. I've been, you know, in Amsterdam for very special tournaments. I started writing for what was, when I was a kid, my favorite chess magazine, premier chess magazine on the planet, asked me to write for them. Like, it's been unbelievable, all the things that have happened.
I can't even believe that you're saying something like you don't know whether it's going to be a success or not, and whether people who are already players of chess will appreciate it. You're beyond that point already, James. I can't understand what you're trying to say there, because you know you've had these amazing experiences meeting the Norwegian chess champion. Is that Magnus?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's already incredible. You've been to tournaments. You've written articles. You're developing your brain. You're going to write a book about this for sure.
Yeah.
It's going to be an amazing book. And if you ever want me to do any help for you on that, because I can already see the intense value out of it.
No, but I would love to maybe separately have a discussion with you. I'd really value your advice on this.
But, you know, when you get older, the brain starts to kind of, doesn't turn to mush, but it starts getting rigid. You start developing patterns of thinking. They get rather set in their ways. And I know I deal with that every day, and I'm guilty of it myself. And something where you can exercise your brain, where you can feel synapses are forming and you're making some progress, for people in their 50s, even in their 40s, it's an incredible lesson. And then for those, you know, people in their 20s and younger are obviously going to be the best chess players in the world. And I talk about why that is so in Mastery. In fact, you know, they're usually in their late 20s or early 30s. And once you get past that point, you burn out because you need that kind of energy and you need a kind of stamina and certain things that you're missing. So it's not going to, your book wouldn't necessarily have value for that crowd. But for anybody else, for even for me, I would just absolutely eat it up.
That's so interesting to hear, because I've been really grappling with this issue. And I have achieved some milestones. For instance, in Georgia, I'm the senior chess champion of Georgia. So for over 50, I've won that 2 years in a row.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and so I've competed in the national senior championship and did very well. But what's very interesting is my volatility is much greater than when I was younger. So I've been able to beat much higher ranked players than when I was younger, but I've also been losing to much lower ranked players than I would lose to when I was younger. So it's like my volatility is really insane.
These are the kinds of things that you have to write down, take notes, and analyze and figure out why that would be. I mean, I'm sure if I thought about it, if I was in your head, I would try and I could figure out why that is the case. But things like that stand out, little anomalies like that, as they say, are very eloquent. They would say a lot about your brain and as it ages. You know, I would think that it's a function. I'm just throwing this out. I could be wrong. Yeah. A function of the ability to focus and concentrate. And so when you're younger, even though young people are so distracted by social media, but if you just subtract all that, they have much greater powers of concentration than we do. As you get older, your mind gets fragmented and you lose that ability to focus very deeply for longer periods of time. And also the stamina that's involved in deep levels of focus. So if I were to randomly speculate, which might be just total BS, it's that your ability to focus deeply for long periods of time with requisite energy has degraded with age, and there's really nothing you can do about that. And you probably will get better at it, but that might be the reason.
I think that's right. Like, what I was thinking recently is that it's directly related to, I never used to think about how tired I was or whether I slept 8 hours. But now, if I don't sleep that 8 hours and then I play chess the next day, if I'm in a four-hour game, particularly later in the afternoon, I'm in big trouble if I'm against the kid, because I will lose focus during the game.
Yeah, that's totally natural. And so, you know, part of your strategy, if you want to get even better, is to work on that and to develop your stamina. I don't know how you would do that through exercises. First of all, building your energy levels up, which is a physical thing, which you'd have to do almost like kind of like running a marathon, just building that up. And then your mental focus. You know, athletes deal with that a lot. And a lot of athletes have come to use things like meditation, which I'm a firm believer in, which help you kind of empty the mind and can help you focus, because what distracts you is having all that buzzing energy going on in your head. And the power to empty that mind is very, very powerful, but it's a muscle you have to develop. And meditation could be a very powerful tool in that sense.
And it is. I mean, what's happened in this journey is that I've had to develop all around as a person. I've had to meditate. I've never had a program of exercise before. Now I exercise every day. I've had to really work on my sleep. I've had to work on my nutrition. I've completely eliminated any drinking or any processed foods, anything that would slow me down. And I've had to improve and I've had to deal with loss. Like, it's hard to lose.
Jay, this is going to be a fantastic book. It's going to be, have you started writing it? What's going on?
Just notes. I haven't started writing it.
You got to get going on that. And I want to urge you, start that process. Like,
I
this
will.
Coming year is the year that you're going to at least write a good portion of that book. Because it'll be an ongoing thing. And then maybe 2 years down the line, you will update it with, you know, more progress. But right now you're at this stage where all these great things are going on. You got to start thinking about it.
Yeah, you're right. And I've been keeping track of all the adventures along the way. It's been really nonstop. And particularly as I'm entering this field now as an accomplished person in other fields. So people know me now in these tournaments in a different way. And it's just been a fascinating experience, although sometimes very depressing one. It's hard to spend 4 hours and then lose. 4 hours like focusing so much, concentrating so much, and then a simple slip and you lose. And it happens frequently.
Really?
Yeah. But the psychology right now for me, 50% of it is mindset.
Yeah.
And it's difficult. Never used to be mindset.
Well, athletes, when they lose, you know, it's a very common phenomenon. In fact, a baseball hitter is going to lose, you know, 95% of the time. They have to deal with this in a very immediate sense because that's their livelihood. And the main thing they do is, if they're successful, is let go of it right away. You know, don't hang on to that feeling of I lost, because it's going to carry over. And you're going to be developing these little glitches in your brain where every time you're at a critical moment in a chess match, the little voice will pop up, that little hitch in your head will make you trip on your own negativity. And so it's very important to release that sense of loss. Okay, you can't repress it. I'm not saying that. That's not functional either. But don't let it sit in you. Okay, so you lost this afternoon. Kind of steam over it through the night, think about it, take notes, analyze why you lost, and then let go of it completely. You have to develop that power. But the best thing to do whenever you have a failure or a setback is to write about it, take notes. You don't want it sitting in your head. The act of writing makes it an object. It objectifies it. It gets it outside and onto paper. And it's an excellent form of releasing. So it's not stuck in your brain. You're not thinking over and over. And also, it's a good way to analyze why you lost in a detached way without emotion, being emotional, going, if I had only done this move instead of that move, the whole game would have turned on that. Why didn't I do that? Why didn't I think of it? Learning lessons and letting go is going to help you immensely in that sense.
It's so funny that you're hitting it dead on. And it's interesting because I never did this when I was younger, but I asked that exact question that you just said, which is not exactly what was the mistake, because I know what the mistake was, but why am I the sort of person who made this mistake? And there's deeper reasons now than I ever realized. Like sometimes, for instance, I'll go for an attack when it's not necessary. And I realized, like, I used to do this when I was a day trader. I was 20 years ago, I day traded. And I would go for very small profits. I would eagerly take small profits, almost as if I was couldn't trust myself that my advantage was real. So I would go for a quick win when I had a small advantage, not trusting that I could build up this advantage for the long term. And there's something in me that goes for tries to go for quick gains.
Well, I remember, now I have to qualify this as I played chess when I was a kid, but I haven't played since then, and I have absolutely zero expertise in it. I've written about great chess people, players in some of my books, but when I researched Bobby Fischer, for example, I noticed that he had crunched so many kind of patterns of games, right? That when he reached a level where he could think many moves in advance. And so the game for him was to be able to think 20, 30 moves in advance. I don't know how many it was in his head. And so he could afford to lose things, to lose a piece here and there, knowing in the overall scheme of things, he had a plan and he was going to realize it. So he wasn't caught up in the moment. He wasn't getting, oh, the player made a mistake. I have to hit on it, because he knew that that could mess up his whole strategy. Even though you have to be in the moment, you can't just be completely in your, you know, going by your plan. But the idea is you want to have a longer term. The players that can play longer term, that are not thinking just of the immediate move, but five or six moves in advance, are going to be the ones that are going to be true masters. So when you make that attack move, you think, oh, you're ready for it, but you're not thinking deeply enough about the consequences of where it will leave you.
You're absolutely right. Like Fischer had, and let's take Magnus Carlsen as a great example too. They have immense confidence in their ability to slowly, incrementally strangle their opponent. Like they don't feel a need. I've got to smash him now, or else I'm going to lose. They don't feel that.
So it gives you a psychological advantage. Like, people who sat down to play against Bobby Fischer knew that he was capable of that, and it already made them fearful. They weren't maybe conscious of it, but playing like Magnus Carlsen, you're already intimidated. You're already losing before the battle begins, to quote Sun Tzu, because you know he has that intimidation factor. It's part of his reputation. I'm not saying you could build that, but if you could get some of that, I think it would really, really make you reach another level.
Yeah, I have to work on this part. I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like, in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like, the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring, so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're here to talk about the new special edition of the 10th year anniversary. Is it 10th year anniversary of 48 Laws of Power? It's 25th. Like 25th.
Yeah. Did you get it?
Yeah. It's beautiful. I have to say, like, the way first off, the gold sides, the new cover, the photo that appears when you bend the pages, when you bend the book a little bit, the photo of you that appears. I mean, it's just a beautifully done book. And it reminds me that you, before you even wrote your first book, you were a book packager. This new edition is like a work of art. It is a packaged book. We'll talk about the writing, but the book itself is like a sculpture.
I have to correct you on one thing there. So first of all, for the audience that doesn't know, I actually did work with a book packager. I'm not the packager. I'm very visually oriented, and I have a lot to do with the design of a book, but I work with a very brilliant man, a Dutchman named Joost Elfers, who is actually a book packager. And the thing is, so as the 25th anniversary, his name is Joost, he wanted to create a special edition. We both agreed on that. And so he went back to 18th century technology, because we're both kind of fascinated by the history of books, and we've talked about it. And the publishing business has become really kind of depressing visually, aesthetically. Mm. Books don't look very good. They're kind of mass-produced. They're junky. They fall apart quickly. Hardback books are very poorly bound, et cetera, et cetera. It's just kind of a junk culture, whereas books used to be objects, used to be something like, wow, it's beautiful. You know, if you collect old books like I have, even books from the 20s and 30s, like modern library editions, they're just beautiful. The covers are beautiful. It's just, and they feel so nice in your hand. So Joost's idea was to go back to an old technology, and he discovered that in the 18th century, they had a way of doing the edges where you could flip the edge and create an image. I thought, this is fantastic. So what he did do is, when you flip in one direction with your thumb, you see a picture of me, a rather young picture, I must admit, because it's a picture of me when the book came out. And then if you flip the other direction, you see an image of Niccolo Machiavelli, who is kind of my mentor, the guiding spirit of the 48 Laws of Power. And then he put it in a very kind of nice, vegan leather cover, and he created a logo for the 48 that's like kind of a new symbol for it. I can't take credit for that. I approved of it, and I said, this is a great idea, but we have to give credit to this man, Joost Elfers. If you know anything about Dutch people, they are brilliant at design, and they have great sense of visuals. So I was very fortunate to have him, because he designed the cover of my first 3 books and the layout of it. So I can't really take credit for it, but this book is now available. It's a limited edition. We've only printed 25,000 copies. And after that, there won't be any more sales. So it will be a collector's item. It's a little bit pricey, $100. But if you're a big fan of the book and you want that kind of collector's item that will be worth a lot maybe in the future, I think it's worth looking into.
I mean, I've been doing this podcast for almost 10 years. So I'm now at that point where I'm seeing a lot of 10th year anniversary editions of books that I first did interviews 10 years ago. And yes, maybe they're expanded editions, but you really, I can't say it enough, like, you really elevated the art form of designing the book, and you and your partner in this,
yeah,
I will give full credit to. And it really was inspirational how you did this. I'm curious, somebody showed me a book the other day. I'm curious if you've seen it. It's called Arete, A-R-R-E-T-E.
Oh, Brian Johnson, of course, yes.
And it's got like 400 chapters in it. It made me think of you a little bit because it also has some element of design. But even the original edition of 48 Laws of Power, I mean, I'm looking at it right now, not the special edition, but I've been on the road for 2 weeks, so I went and bought this just the other day. But you have like stories on the left side, stories on the right side, stories in the middle. Like, I've never seen a book written with so, like, the form itself is telling a story. And we've talked about this before, but even the original edition I felt was very much a work of art. It's how I've always, what I love about reading is that sometimes it's not just the story that's important, but the way the story is presented that itself is part of the overall narrative of the book. And I felt that was the case with your book. I just want to also comment that, and again, we've talked a lot about the ideas in the 48 Laws of Power, but I read this book fairly frequently. I won't say I read the whole thing, sure, you know, once a year, but I'll read like every few months, I'll pick it up and read a few chapters or read at least one chapter because there's so much depth in this, so many stories, so many ideas. It's like you show so many historical stories that it's like a history of the world through the concept of power and manipulation and persuasion. I mean, did you think about it in that context?
I thought the book should have, like, a lot of books are just kind of one-dimensional, in my opinion. They're very academic. They're very dry. They have kind of one simple idea that they're trying to express. But we're animals. We live through our senses. We're not just brain, just not intellects. We also live through our senses. And power is something that isn't just an intellectual phenomenon. It deals with nonverbal communication. It deals with visuals. It deals with sounds. It's a whole world. It's a whole language, right? And it's also a major theme of it is seduction, the ability to get people to lower their normal resistance to you so you can influence them. And so the way I conceive the book is it's not just the text that matters. It's how it looks and how it's structured. So when you tell a story, as everybody knows who watches a film, or when you're a child and you hear a fairy tale or some fable, you're immediately kind of the moment you hear someone start to tell a story, you relax, you're interested, you're focusing, you want to know what happens, you want to know what's next, etc. Stories are powerful in themselves because they draw people into your environment and they make them lose their normal defensive quality. So my idea was I'm not going to hit people over the head with theories about power, et cetera, how boring, how stupid. Right. I'm going to draw you in through stories about people throughout history. I'm going to make you identify with these characters like you identify with a character in a movie. You identify with Louis XIV, even in a perverse way. You might even identify with Cesare Borgia. You'll kind of feel something about the con artists that I use in the book. And it's on and on and on. So I'm trying to envelop you, the reader, in this kind of world of power and alter how you think about it from the inside out. So there has to be several dimensions. It can't just be this flat book in your hand with text that you read. It has to like infiltrate your mind, infiltrate your defenses. That is power. Machiavelli wrote his book in print around 1514, somewhere around there. And people are reading it to this day. You know, it has had immense influence. It's had this influence because he wrote in that dimensional way. He told these stories. He made it kind of strong. He used the language that I didn't imitate exactly, but I imitated the overall concept of it. But his book has lasted because he didn't just write a book. He created this phenomenon, this world that you enter. So that was sort of, that was my mentor. That was my paradigm. That was the pattern I wanted to follow.
But one thing you do that's different from him, as you mentioned, The Prince is a very short book. Part of the idea of your book is that there are so many stories and so much history and so many examples of each of these 48 concepts that in itself, you could drown in this book. Like there's so much material. What gave you the idea to, I mean, I've seen other people now mimic your style over the years, where they talk about some historical concept and they give stories like, oh, so-and-so, back in 1765, George Washington was having a problem and blah, blah, blah. But you really are able to get so many concise stories in here. What was the thinking there in terms of the quantity?
Well, it's quantity and it's quality. So the quantity
is... Of course, the quality is assumed.
Well, the quantity comes from the fact that here I am, a person, 38 years old when I start writing the book, more or less. I've never had power in my life. I've always been kind of on the middle level. I never held a job more than 11 months. I was always the guy outside looking in, observing people with power. I was not Henry Kissinger. I was not a famous movie producer or anything like that. So how can I write a book about power? People might laugh at me. They might say, what are your qualifications? My father would say, Robert, you don't have a PhD in this. You sure you can write that book? Well, my dad was a very nice person. So, you know, he was on to something, though. So it was a concern. So I had spent many years being a researcher in Hollywood, and I had honed those kind of skills in journalism and in college, et cetera. And so I'm very adept in using libraries for research. So my idea was to ground this book in reality. So it's not just some 37-year-old who's never had a position of power, who's just, you know, spewing nonsense. I had to ground it in reality. So that meant ancient cultures to show that these things are timeless. I had to include Asia, stories from China and Japan. I had to include stories from Africa. I had to include stories from the Arab world. I had to make it international, all periods of time, all cultures, etc. That's a massive task. But when you put all that together, then you have to say, this is something that's human. It transcends the moment. It's 1998 when the book was out, but it's also something that was real 600 BC. And then you see it's also universal, it covers all cultures. So having that pastiche of all those different cultures and periods and all stories, also from every particular angle. So I have artists, I have generals, I have political leaders, I have criminals and con artists, you know, I have art dealers, I have chess players. So coming from all these angles, all those periods, all those cultures says, this book has the feel of reality. You know, and that was sort of the task that I gave myself. Now, I was younger and I had more energy then, so I was able to do, now I still do the same thing, but it takes me so much longer to do, just like your chess problem. But
it's interesting because I think with age, the ability to recognize common patterns in different historical situations probably increases. You know, it's not a math problem, it's kind of an experience problem. And so the way you weave in, you know, like in one chapter, the same chapter will include some story about Roosevelt, some story about Cleopatra, some story about Borgia, all to make the point that these people cleverly manipulated other people to do what they wanted, because if they had done it, they would have been perceived negatively by the population as opposed to the way they ultimately did it. This is in the chapter on basically using other people to do be as clean as possible. Don't get your hands dirty. And which is one of the 48 chapters. But there's this sense of validity when you show all these stories. I feel like I'm getting smarter. And so part of the reason I like the book is you're making me think I'm smarter by reading it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, some of the most satisfactory feedback that I've gotten is, I remember maybe 15, 20 years ago, a librarian at the Dade County Library in Miami wrote to me, and it's in an inner city area. Most of the people that go to that library were African American. He said there were kids there, like 10 years old, who would come in, or probably a little bit older, and they would read the book, and suddenly they were getting turned on to history, and they wanted to read about Julius Caesar, and they wanted to read about Haile Selassie, and they wanted to read about Cleopatra, et cetera. So I've had a lot of people who aren't normally readers of history get excited and become students of history. And a lot of it comes from the fact that history can be a very dry subject. It can be a very dull subject because academia generally kind of deadens anything that it touches, I believe. Whereas, and I'm writing right now for my new book, a chapter on my relationship to history. But history shouldn't be like that. History was people who were alive, who were facing dramatic moments, who were living in everyday situations, who had insecurities. They could be just as neurotic as people in the 21st century. They had problems. They were narcissists. So they were living in the moment. They were alive. And history doesn't, a lot of books don't come from that. They don't express that. They describe it as if they're just these dead people. They have facts and theories, etc. But we humans aren't theories. We're not just these grand patterns in history. We're living individuals. So when I write about Roosevelt, or I write about Borgia, or I write about Julius Caesar, I'm trying to say they're human beings. They're not necessarily these legends. They're facing dramatic situations in which they could lose, and loss for them means death. And I wanted to draw you into the drama of history. And history, to me, should be the most exciting subject of all, to just realize that our past includes some of the most insane things that have happened, things that just absolutely blow your mind. I'm describing in my current book the conquest of Mexico, of Aztecs by Cortez. And I'm describing when they first arrive at the city of Tenochtitlan, which was what Mexico City was. The Spaniards are going, oh my God, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life, this city. I'm like dreaming. I don't believe that it's real. And these are the actual accounts of the conquistadors. And I go on to describe what that city looked like. It's like something from a fairy tale. It's like something from a dream. History has all of these kinds of stories into it. It's not a dead subject. It's something incredibly sexy, incredibly seductive, incredibly alive. So that's sort of the attitude I bring to it.
I think also what makes it really stand out in this book is that the book is not called a history book. It's called The 48 Laws of Power.
Yeah.
So I pick this up and I think, oh, well, I'm going to be a powerful person after I read this. But I'm learning about how to have power in my own life, how to have more agency in my own life by reading about some guy named Cao Cao in China, you know, 6,000 BC China or whatever it was, and all these incredible historical stories that I had no idea about. And I think, oh, that applies to me. I'll let Jay do my dirty work instead of me doing it.
Or get other people works. To do the work and take credit for it. Law number 7.
Yeah, well, that was interesting too. Like, there's a very keen sense that you always have to know where you are in the hierarchy to know how to use different laws. Like, Henry Kissinger wasn't the president. And if he there's a lot of warning in this book. If you outshine the person higher in the hierarchy, you're dead.
Yeah, yeah. You know, people often say a criticism of the book, and I'm open to criticism of anything that I write. But one thing they'll say is some of the laws contradict each other. You say court attention at all cost, and then you say other laws have to do with kind of disguising yourself and not being so out there. Isn't that a contradiction? Well, as you rightfully point out, everything depends on context, who you are. I'm writing a book for everybody. So some people, if you're 23 years old and you've just entered a workplace, you don't want to outshine the master. You have so much to lose. You're going to be fired. It's a common mistake. But if you're 38, 39, you're head of a company, et cetera, then you're in a much different circumstance. And I make that point in the book that the problem with people with power is they think in these large general terms, and everything depends on the particular circumstance. You have to be able to think for yourself. You have to be able to think in the moment. If you entered a chess game with everything mapped out in advance, you would lose. You have to be a little bit alive to the moment. You have to see who your opponent is, what they're doing. So sometimes one strategy will work. Sometimes another strategy will work. It's not like this cookie cutter thing where every law must be followed to the T. What is the last law of the book? The last law of the book is called assume formlessness. And the idea is take everything that I've written in this book and just throw it out and be in the moment and be formless and adapt to the situation to be like water, like Bruce Lee said, and just kind of flow with the moment and don't be stuck on these particular laws. I kind of contradicted my whole book in Law 48. And each law has what I call a reversal. Mm. You might want to do the reverse of this law because life isn't this static little game. It's a very fluid thing. One strategy, one moment will lead to disaster and another moment it'll be perfect. So get rid of this mentality a lot of people have that everything has to be this straight category. You're a terrible strategist if that's how you think. You have to be able to adapt to everything that happens to you.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You know, this whole concept of using these laws of power, depending on where you are in the hierarchy, the way you were just talking about it reminds me of basically the definition of talent. So you have to have enough self-awareness to fuel your talent so you are better than the people who are just following some other example or doing something by rote or they have it all mapped out. Like take Talleyrand as an example. He's a character that kind of threads his way through the book. And he was an advisor to Napoleon and others in the various stages of the French government. He was very talented, knowing exactly where he stood in every single hierarchy he seemed to be in. And that's a difficult thing to do because sometimes people think they're higher in the hierarchy or sometimes they think they're lower in the hierarchy.
Well, it all comes down to self-awareness and observing and just thinking and being alive in the moment and not being caught up in the past. Talleyrand was what we would call an opportunist, and he saw everything around him as an opportunity. So probably some things we wouldn't want to necessarily imitate in Talleyrand, but he didn't really have any political convictions. He would assume the convictions that suited the moment, the political moment. If it was Napoleon and the revolution, he became a revolutionary. Then when Napoleon became an emperor, he became noble and royalty. And then when the king returned, he was now in favor of the king. But he was aware of each situation and how it changed. And the problem that a lot of people have, so this is something that comes from Machiavelli. And I noticed this in a lot of leaders, a lot of people who attain power. They kind of hit a wall and they can't get past it. And I see this in almost everybody that I deal with in my consulting with powerful people. You reach a level of power through one particular quality that you have, whether it's arrogance, whether it's in supreme confidence, whether it's sheer aggressiveness, whether it's being very seductive and influent and excellent powers of persuasion or eloquent, etc. You reach your power through this one thing that is a quality that you have that's very strong. And now you have this position. And you've reached a new level in the hierarchy, as you say. And what brought you there is no longer relevant, is no longer a powerful quality. You have to adapt. And Machiavelli said that this is what undoes a lot of people. They cannot adapt to the moment. And if he were to craft a perfect leader, it'd be somebody who would alter with each circumstance. So it's a common phenomenon in military where a lieutenant, a soldier will rise to a position of power in the military back probably a couple hundred years ago. And then suddenly they didn't know how to adapt to their new position and they were absolutely useless. people who reach a certain level. I know one guy I consulted with. He worked in a brokerage firm. He was an incredibly successful trader, etc. He was a salesman, basically. He got promoted to a management level, and it all fell apart because he didn't know how to manage. All he knew was how to sell. And I worked for a company, American Apparel, where the guy was this incredible entrepreneur, Dove Charney, very charismatic, very powerful, very aggressive. He created this incredible empire, American Apparel, with stores all over the world. But he couldn't organize it. He couldn't manage it. He was not good dealing with people because he only knew one, he only had one gear in life. And I kept trying to tell him, you've got to adapt, but he wouldn't listen to me. And so the lesson for people in the world today is your circumstances are always changing. You might rise up in the hierarchy, you might fall down. You have to adapt your mind to where you are, to the circumstances that you're facing. You have to adapt your mind to the world as it is. So your industry, my work is in publishing. Publishing is changing by the moment. To publicize a book now in 2023 is completely different from how you publicized a book in 2018. So you have to be alive to how everything in the world is changing in the moment. You can't be stuck in the past. You can't be stuck in a moment, you know, what brought you to success and power. You have to continually adapt.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting that you also have examples of people who were brilliant but couldn't adapt to their circumstances or didn't understand the circumstances quite correctly. So like you talked about the difference between Tesla and Thomas Edison. And I really didn't understand the level to which Tom Edison wasn't really a technologist and was more just a businessman slash salesman. And Tesla was a true technologist who didn't really understand business at all and was too trusting. And I want, you know, and he kept falling into the same traps, whether it was with Edison or Westinghouse or JP Morgan. Like, what could someone like that have done to sort of adapt a little better? Or do you think he was just incapable? Maybe he was so good at his technology, it gave him an inability somehow to read people.
Yeah, I think, you know, some people, a lot of people who are very talented, who are very creative, either in sciences or in the arts, can be very naive. And I definitely fall into that category. I was a very naive person when I entered the work world for quite a long time. I still have a little bit of that seed of naivete in me. And
how so? What's an example?
Of what?
Of you being naive in the industry?
Law number one, never outshine the master. I violated that law once and twice and possibly a third time, which I'm not sure of. Of course, it was before I wrote the book. But I was aware, you know, I was trying really hard to please people. I had a job, for instance, on a television show as a researcher. And essentially, the more stories that got produced from your research, the better you were, obviously. There was like a hard, fast metric for it. And I was by far, I don't mean to brag, because I'm not good at a lot of things, but I was good at this one thing. I had by far the highest number of stories that were being produced. And so I thought, well, you know, that gives me a lot of confidence. I can almost do anything I want. I kind of dressed, you know, this is the 90s. I kind of dressed in a grunge way. I didn't really care what I looked like. When we had meetings, I wasn't really paying deep attention. Anyway, I ran afoul of my boss and I got fired. Essentially, I had developed an attitude thinking that I was greater. I was so good that that was what was mattered. But what mattered? Once you fit into a group, people have egos. So that person that fired me probably thought, this young kid thinks he's better than I am. He's after my job, et cetera, et cetera. I made her insecure, and therefore I suffered. And so I wasn't aware that people could be political. I wasn't aware that people had these egos. And early on in my career, when I was in New York, when I was working for magazines, I made a lot of mistakes that way. I didn't have this radar that goes, that person you're dealing with, they're insecure, they're your boss, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to kind of tailor what you do and what you say according to what you gauges their insecurities. So I was naive in that sense. I had all of these ideas coming from college that what mattered was just being good at what you do, being creative, etc. But no, you have to be political in this world. So I was naive that way.
Do you think you increased your skills in this area, or do you think researching this book increased your skills? Like what snapped you out of it?
I got better out of it as I suffered, as I made mistakes and I learned from my mistakes and I analyzed them. I was progressively getting better. And then, you know, I've always been very observant of people. So as I said, I never really had power, but I was always kind of watching them. But I had blind spots, which is one thing that I revealed here now. So I wasn't perfect in my ability to observe and gauge where people were. So I was always pretty good, but I had some of these blind spots. And one of those blind spots was thinking, I'm so creative, I'm so superior to everyone that I can just get away with things. And that's a terrible, terrible mistake. And yes, in writing the books, obviously, I've upped my game, you know, and it's not going to be easy to trick me or manipulate me now that I've written the book, obviously, because I can see through anything a mile, 10,000 miles away. And people still who I've hired to work for me or other people, they still try and play games with me. And they don't realize that I wrote the book on that. You can't really fool me at this point, you know?
You know, it's interesting you use the phrase blind spots, because I was almost thinking as I was rereading this book that it is a book about blind spots, because there is no manipulation without someone being blind to the machinations of another person. And in each case, whether it's someone who's very powerful being persuaded by someone less powerful, like a Talleyrand persuading Napoleon, or in the cases of someone trying to impress Louis XIV, but then outshining him, so getting killed. Like in each case, all these people do have blind spots. And that's when you fall into the hole of the blind spot is where trouble occurs.
Yeah, I tell a story. One of my favorite stories in the book involves a very famous con artist named Count Victor Lustig, who nobody knows exactly where he came from, but he operated in Florida in the United States. And one time he decided to con Al Capone. Now that takes real cojones, if you know what I mean. If he catches on that you're trying to con Al Capone, you're going to be, you know, wrapped in cement and thrown into a river. But he went to Al Capone and he goes, "Mr. Capone, you give me $50,000. He presented himself as this incredible, business person. You give me $50,000, I'll be able to double it for you in 3 months. Okay?" And Al Capone goes, "I don't know, but the guy seems so confident. I'll give it a shot. Why not? You know, I've got the money." So he gave it to him. And then 3 months later, he comes to Al Capone's office and he goes, "Mr. Capone, I'm really sorry. It didn't pan out the way I did. The money is lost. I feel absolutely terrible. You trusted me, you know, and I felt so honored that you trusted me, and I failed. And is there anything I can do for you to make up for this?" And Al Capone goes, "Well, I appreciate your sincerity, Mr. Lustig, and don't just let it go. It's all right. We'll just forget about it, okay? All right, but I won't do business with you again, but just forget about it." Okay, well, that was the con, was those $50,000. And the way he conned him was his sincerity. And by buttering up to him, because I left out part of the story, which he was flattering Mr. Capone, how smart he was, how great he was. And so he knew Al Capone's weak spot, which was he thought he was a tough guy. And here he was appealing to his softer side. So to give Al Capone the chance to be noble and go, "Oh, that's all right, I'll forgive it," was incredibly appealing to his ego. And Victor Lustig was a master of psychology, and he knew that even though he might be killed, more likely he'll ask for some of that money back. "All right, I'll just give it back because I have it." Or he'll forgive me. "I have nothing to lose." And so, you know, the con game worked, because even the most evil, the most violent man on the planet has a blind spot. the need to be flattered, the need to feel noble and better than what he was.
Yeah, you have a similar story. It's not a Khan per se, but about Genghis Khan. So here's a person who basically destroys everything in his path, but he has this one advisor who has figured out how to persuade him to keep different cities alive and so on. And you know, another example where someone lower on the hierarchy is able to manipulate and persuade someone much more powerful. Like this person might not have had the skills to be a Genghis Khan, but he had the skills to manipulate a Genghis Khan.
Well, he knew that it's a law about self-interest. Instead of appealing to people's sense of generosity or morality in all cases, you want to appeal to their self-interest. And he understood that Genghis Khan was that kind of person. If you can show me what I can get out of it, I'll do what you want. So he basically persuaded him that if he annihilated the city, if he killed 1 million people, as he often would do when he destroyed a civilization or an empire, you're going to lose this, this, and this. It's going to hurt you in the end. And he gave very rational reasons for it. So he said, you need to preserve this particular place because in the long run, you'll be able to get so much out of it. I don't remember the exact details, but he appealed to his self-interest. And so the book is designed, if you read all of the examples, to give you so many patterns in your head of possible, let's just compare it to chess, patterns of moves that you can make in life, depending on your circumstances. Sometimes it's that person you're dealing with, all they think about is what's in it for me. All right, you tailor your effort at persuasion for what's in it for them. But at the same time, what's in it for them is actually what's in it for you. You know, be clever. Or sometimes it's appealing to people's noble sense of self, making them feel like they're a king or an emperor by how you frame it, etc. Sometimes you have to be really aggressive and intimidate people. Other times you have to use the surrender tactic and make yourself look weak so they take you for granted. And then when they let their guard down, then you attack them. Each circumstance in life requires a particular law, a particular way of thinking. That's to me what power is, the person who can do that.
And it's also very interesting what you say about the influence of time, in the sense that time actually, like a past history with somebody, is almost worthless when you're trying to persuade them. So you have the story of Athens. It might have been even in the same chapter as the Genghis Khan story. The story of Athens trying to decide which city to partner with. And one city approaches Athens and says, hey, we've been friends forever. We've had a history. Choose us. And the other city says, look, we hate each other, but let's be blunt. Our combined navies will destroy Sparta. And that's the city that Athens went with.
Yeah, I mean, the Athenians were very practical people. I mean, they created a democracy and they thought of themselves as superior to other cultures, but they had this very Machiavellian side. They were very practical people. They were great business people. They were merchants. It was a commercial city. They were seamen. They were very fluid in their thinking as opposed to the Spartans. Right? And so they were very open to an appeal that would increase their security and their power because they lived in a very insecure world. So I tell people, when you're trying to get a more powerful person on your side, which this small island was trying to do with the great Athens, don't try and say, you know, I've done favors for you in the past, you need to do this for me, or this is what, you know, I'm really great. I can do all these really wonderful things for you. Instead, tailor your argument, your attempt at persuasion at exactly what they need, what is in their self-interest, what will make them look better, what will make them more productive, what will make them more money, what will give them more success in life. Nobody can resist that. If somebody came to me, instead of saying, Robert, I have brilliant ideas. I can be your best assistant you ever had, which people do if they said, Robert, I can save you time. I understand that you're probably way overworked and you can't deal with all these things going on right now. I'm going to literally save you time by doing this, 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 this. I will organize your life. It'll be hard for me to resist. I'm not asking people to do that. Please don't get me wrong. But if instead, if you appeal to what people need, what their weakness is, and the weakness most people have in the world today is time. They're just overworked. They don't have time for all these little details that they're facing. So be strategic in life. That's what it comes to. Just don't be all about your ego and about who you are and how great you are. Be strategic and think about the other person and the circumstances and what will get you what you need.
You know, one thing I notice in all of your books is you rarely write about yourself. I sort of feel like there's two main styles of nonfiction that I really enjoy. There's what I literally call in my house the Robert Greene style, which is kind of making these different, talking about these different concepts through tons of really great historical examples. And then there's almost the, what I'll call the Charles Bukowski story, style, the dirty realism of like, he just talks about himself and gives his opinions throughout these outrageous stories about himself that are more or less true. And you've never really written about yourself at all, but I know you have many interesting stories. Is there a reason you don't write about yourself?
Well, I appreciate the Charles Bukowski style of writing very much so, and there are people who are very brilliant at it. I guess it just doesn't fit me. I've always felt I think it's because I had so many years of failure in my life. And I'm being realistic about that. By the time I wrote The 48 Laws of Power, I was essentially pretty much a failure. I had had 50, 60 different jobs. I couldn't stay at one more than a few months. I was never really made that much money. I tried many things and I failed at being a screenwriter. I failed really being a good journalist. I failed at writing novels. So built into me, I was kind of beaten up, you know? And so I thought, a slight inferiority complex, like, who am I to write a book about power? Who am I to write a book about seduction or warfare and strategy? Okay, well, if I wrote about myself, it just wouldn't feel right. And so I don't feel comfortable in just using personal examples because I don't think they have weight behind them. Whereas, so things in the moment, in the present, are very hard for us to gauge. It's very hard to say that Elon Musk is this incredible genius or Elon Musk is this incredible failure. In 30 years, we will know very definitely what he was, and history will be written on the subject because they will understand the context, they will understand how things play out. So if I write about my little personal stories about, you know, things I dealt with, like I mentioned when I got fired, it kind of makes the idea sort of trivial and banal, and it just seems like it's just personal. Whereas if I talk about the same idea with Louis XIV and a man who outshone Louis XIV and gets thrown in prison for the rest of his life, well, then the reader goes, wow, yeah, that's really interesting. That's exciting. I can understand that. So I just don't feel like my personal stories rise to the level of something that, you know, I don't mind talking about them in podcasts, but I'm trying to write books that are going to last for 50, 100, 200 years. And writing about my little personal experiences, they don't seem large enough. They don't seem mythic, you know.
But since the age of 38, though, you've gone on this adventure. You've become this massive best-selling author. You are the person who's written the books on war, seduction, power. You know, you co-wrote a book with 50 Cent, his take on the power. And you've had, I mean, you, like you've mentioned before, you've consulted with major companies. Like, when, after this book was published, when did you realize your life was changing because of this book?
Well, I think the real wake-up moment for me was about 4 months later. I got invited to Italy of the Italian version of the book had just come out. It was my first real international book tour. And I get there and like, I'm wined and dined. I'm taken to the island of Capri, which if you've ever known, is just incredibly beautiful. I had paparazzi like taking photographs of me as I emerge out of the water, you know, out of the Mediterranean. You know, I'm eating in these fancy restaurants, and then I'm taken to Rome where I meet a man named Andreotti, who used to be the president of Italy, who had written a review of the 48 Laws of Power because he's considered like the most Machiavellian politician in Italian recent politics. You know, Jesus Christ, I compared it to like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride at Disneyland, where it takes you through this like hallucinogenic drug experience where you're going through all these little things and you're like 8 years old. You go, whoa, this is insane. It was like Mr. Toad's Wild Ride because I had nothing like that ever happened in my life before. So that was when it started to go, something here is changing. And then slowly, as like a year later, I read that Jay-Z quoted the book in a Playboy interview. I started seeing that it's infiltrated the hip-hop world. So it's entering popular culture. That was like another kind of second revelatory moment. So it had these little moments along the way.
I'm just curious, did ups and downs still continue for you, but in a different way? Like, you know, what were some down moments?
Yeah, I mean, when The Art of Seduction came out, it literally came out 2 days after 9/11. And nobody was interested in my book, and rightfully so. But it was like, oh my God, you know, my second book is out and nobody's going to write about it. Very selfish of me. You know, I must admit that, you know, it's natural that people feel that way and I'm admitting something bad, but I understood it very quickly. But I was very worried. But then the other one came when I was doing the 50 Cent book. I was so intimidated by him that I thought this book has to be about 50. And so I spent months tagging along with him and looking at his business and everything. And I wrote a good portion of the book, kind of following his examples. And it was mostly just focused on him. And then, like, as I was nearing the end of it, the publisher of that book, Simon & Schuster, I believe, time, they canceled the project, ostensibly because we were too late in delivering it. But I think they didn't think it was very good. And somebody else, another publisher at Harper's, came in and said, I will take over this project, but Robert, I have to tell you something. And he said, honestly, this isn't the right kind of book that you should have been writing. It should be more about you and your way of thinking and not so obsessed with 50 and everything that he's ever done. It should be a book that kind of reflects my way of thinking. You have to change the whole thing. You've spent a year writing this thing. You have to throw it away. And you have to do something else. And on top of that, you only have 8 months or 9 months to finish it. Whoa. First of all, a blow to my ego, me who's written 3 bestsellers. Yeah, I failed. And it's true. And he was right. I had to admit that I was wrong. But it was a very depressing moment. And then to realize that I have to go get a whole new approach to it, and then I have only so much time to get it done, that was a moment that said, you're not as great as you necessarily think you are. You can make mistakes, and you made a mistake. So be more aware of it. Don't let your ego get involved in this kind of thing. Although in this case, it was the opposite. I was trying, my ego was like going down, and instead of asserting itself more in this particular project.
And what's the new book you've mentioned you're working on? What's that about?
Well, it's a book about what I call the sublime. And in the 10th chapter of the 50 Cent book, I talk about it. And in the 18th chapter of the Laws of Human Nature, I talk about it in relation to our mortality and death. And so it's something I've wanted to been writing for 17 years, but I got sidetracked by other projects. I've been thinking about it and I've put it in other books, but essentially the idea is that we live in a world that's kind of limited. Human beings live in a world that are conventional, that have certain codes of behavior. And I compare it to a circle. And inside that circle, are everything that you're supposed to think, ways you're supposed to behave, ideas you're allowed to have, you know, behavior that's acceptable. That circle won't look the same, won't be the same as it was in ancient Egypt. They won't have the same codes of how to think, how to behave, but there's still a circle because we're very conventional. We try to order human life according to these codes and conventions. Well, the sublime is everything that lies outside that circle. What we're not supposed to think about, patterns, ideas that we're not supposed to entertain, behavior that we're not really supposed to have. And when you tell somebody, this isn't really what is acceptable, this isn't really what you're supposed to think about, it immediately stirs the desire to go beyond those limits because that's who human beings are. We have this perverse streak in us. And so the ultimate thing outside that circle is death itself. Like, we don't know what death is. Nobody knows what it's about. But to feel it, to go outside and to actually touch upon it, a near-death experience, is like an insanely sublime moment. It teaches you so much. It makes you realize that the world is not what you think it is. 50 Cent had that moment when he got shot 9 times and nearly died. He had that kind of epiphany when he was lying in the hospital bed and he thought he was dying. And so 5 years ago, I had a stroke. I came this close to dying myself. And I had, a kind of experience. And so I thought, well, this is my moment. I have to write the book now, because I had just written a chapter 2 months earlier about death and the sublimeness of it. And here it actually happened to me. So somebody out there, some fate, some God is telling me this is the moment to write the book. Because it's now like something deeply personal, deeply emotional, deeply visceral to me. And the thing is, when I first conceived of the book, probably about 2006, it's a subject that fascinates me. I was going to like jet all over the world. I was going to go to the Gobi Desert. I was going to climb mountains. I was going to go to Tierra del Fuego. I was going to swim with dolphins. I was going to have all these sublime experiences. And now since I had the stroke, I can't do any of that, right? I'm very limited in what I can do. I can barely walk outside my house. So I have to make this book about what's inside your head. I have to make this sublime an experience that you can have even if you're disabled like I am, even if you can't go to the Gobi Desert, even if you can't even go down to San Diego, for God's sake. Because it's in your head. It's an internal experience that will change you. And it can happen just looking at your pets. It can happen just listening to music. It can happen reading a book. It can happen anywhere in the city that you live in. It's forced me to make the book about that. And so each chapter in the book is about an element that lies outside that circle. Some of it has to do with our relationship to the cosmos and the universe and the Big Bang Theory and things we've learned. There's a lot of science in this book. Some of it has to do with evolution and how insane it is that you and I, James, are talking on this call right now when a mere 10,000 years ago, which is nothing in the course of history, we were basically Neolithic period. Nothing like this. It's just so improbable that this has happened the way it has happened. There's, you know, a chapter about the brain and how it operates and how our brains kind of create our reality and stepping outside. The chapter about childhood, chapter about animals, chapter about love, one about history, which is the one that I'm currently writing. So each chapter, there are going to be 12 of them, covers something that's outside that circle.
So like, for instance, when you write about history, what do you point out as sublime? Like, what's an example?
Well, I kind of mentioned it when I talked about Tenochtitlan in that city, which has completely disappeared. So when the Spaniards, the conquistadors, destroyed the Aztec civilization, they burned everything down to the ground. There's not one single piece of architecture remaining from that. There's a few scattered sculptures, et cetera, which you'll find in the museum in Mexico City, and some literature. But basically, the whole civilization was wiped off this planet. And yet, it's the most insanely incredible. People who lived there just thought it was normal, thought it was real. But for the Spanish people who went there and saw it, first of all, they were kind of terrified by the human sacrifices. So they had a kind of a repulsion, attraction to this culture. But aesthetically, sensuously, it was the most insanely wonderful thing they had ever seen. They never got over that experience, right? So history contains those moments that I'm trying to show you, that I call history uncanny. And if you know the definition of uncanny, it's a mix of things that are familiar and unfamiliar, like in a dream. So in a dream, people are kind of familiar, but they're acting differently. They're familiar, but they're not. They're doing things different. And that's what makes a dream so strange and weird and compelling. If everything was familiar, a dream wouldn't be interesting. If everything was strange, it wouldn't draw you in or stick with you. But that mix of things is like a dream is what is so compelling. History is like that. The people are different. The culture is different. How they were thinking, how they dressed, how they smelled, how they the food they ate. But then there's something familiar about it. There's something about the human experience that has never changed. That mix of things is like a dream. And so when I enter ancient Babylonia, when I try and enter like the world of Paleolithic, our ancestors, or the Chinese city in the 10th century, I have that feeling like I'm entering a dream, like it's almost too fantastical to believe that this is actually part of our heritage. So history is completely sublime. We don't look at it that way, which is what my chapter is about. I'm trying to alter, reverse your perspective. It's not a dead thing. It's something that's very, very alive.
And do you think having the stroke and kind of forcing you to be not as physical has opened even vaster new vistas for yourself in terms of finding the sublime in the everyday things around you?
Yes, it does, because, you know, what am I going to do? First of all, when I write a book, I have to live it in some degree. I have to feel it inside of me. I can't just write about things that are abstract. And so I have to have some of these experiences that I'm writing about. And so it's forced me to find those moments. You know, so if I write about animals, because I have a very long, deep relationship to the animal world, it's something I've always been attracted to. And I wrote about our relationship to animals and some amazing stories. When I look at birds, I never look at them in the same way because of this story that I wrote. Or when I look at my own pets that we have in our house here, I have to bring that kind of awareness to it. Then when I'm writing about history, I can't go to Rome and look at the ruins there and feel it in the moment as I planned to when I wrote was writing in 2006. I have to do it in my head. I have to do it in my armchair. And I'm able to do that because I have a strategy, and I share that strategy with the reader about how you can make those things happen. You can do it through reading. You can do it through looking at images, but you have to do it with a certain mindset. So each chapter I have to live through. And I can tell you one thing. My life is very limited. You know, I can't do the things I used to do. I can't hike. I can't swim. I can't ride a normal bicycle. I have a special bicycle. But those moments in the day after our podcast is over, where I have those 3 or 4 hours to write, it's the only thing I live for. It's the most magical moment of my day because it just like gives me a spark. So yeah, I've had to live this book in a way that I couldn't have done it before my stroke.
And when's the book coming out? When do you think you'll finish?
That's the million-dollar question. I'm on chapter 8. I'll be finishing that in a month, and there are 12 chapters. So if I really get my act together, which is going to be not that easy, I'm hoping it'll be ready in 2025. Not this coming fall, but the fall after that.
Well,
because books take like 9 months to go through a system.
I can't wait to read this one. I remember you talking about it and also us speaking about it when we spoke about the laws of human nature. But it sounds incredible. So I can't wait for it. Well, Robert, as always, I benefit so much from these conversations. And also when I'm preparing for a podcast with you, and we've had many now, I always go through your books again. And it's just, I get new perspectives each time out of it. Like these books have really changed me, and I'm really grateful you've written them. And just your writing also, I don't want to, you have a very good, blunt style of writing about these historical events. There's almost a poetry in your lack of poetry in how you describe these events.
Thank you.
It's you're telling it how it is, but it's in a very compelling way. And the storytelling aspect is kind of hidden in how you write it, as opposed to being very overt about it, if that makes any sense. But I always learn from your style. And again, we spoke about before the podcast, I feel I could sometimes I read books and I say, oh, this guy's copying Robert Greene, but not doing it as well. And I don't mean to put them down. It's very hard, I think, to write like you, but I think it created a genre, the way you write. And I always see that when I read these books, in addition to the usual just vast amount of knowledge and I get from your books. So thank you again. I'm really glad you put out this special edition. For one thing, it's a beautiful book, but another thing, gave us another chance to speak. And I am going to take you up on your offer to help me a little in this, how to structure this yeah. book. It's the first time I'm writing a concept book like this. I've written sort of books where each chapter sort of stands on its own, but this one has a real cohesive thread, and I have not done that before.
Yeah, and I want you, when we talk about this, I'm going to try and get you to loosen up, to think of this book in a way that maybe you haven't thought about it before, and to not be so tight and be a little more creative with how you approach it, not at all criticizing your past books, but just
no, I agree.
Great works. It's like it's a new type of book for you, and you have to approach it in a new way, and I will help you with that. I don't help many people because I'm way inundated with work, but I genuinely believe this could be an extremely exciting book.
Well, I'm grateful for that. And you're right. Like, thinking about it and talking with you about it, I realize I've been very rigid in how this book has to begin and how this book has to end. And of course, that guides the middle as well. So, but you're right. I've already been experiencing incredible things that are book worthy, and I'm not a 22-year-old. I don't have to write about how I become, you know, champion of this or champion of that. It's the experience itself has been this incredible adventure.
Yeah, and how you write it is going to be the key to making it compelling for the reader, because just on its own, it's not going to work like that. You have to approach it a certain way. And I can feel it in my head. I'd have to spend time and discuss it with you. But I have a sense, as we say in German, a Fingerspitzengefühl, about how it could be. But I'm not going to take time now doing that. But, you know, I think it has to be more of like a story. And not in reading this story, you're going to learn a lot. But I don't want like chapter one, this is the lesson here. Chapter two, this is the lesson here. Yeah. I want it more loosely structured.
Yeah, this is a very good way to think about it. It gives me a lot of food for thought. So thanks again, Robert, for coming on the show. And the special edition of the 48 Laws of Power is just a beautiful work of art. Not to mention, the book is a great book, but I really just love how the book is designed and packaged. And it's a special book. So I encourage people to look at it or get it or whatever they want to do with it. But if you don't get that book, get the first edition, which also is a beautiful book. So enjoy. And Robert, once again, thanks. And thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, James. I really enjoyed it. I always enjoy it. So whenever you want me, just let me know.
Excellent. Me too.
NetCredit is here to say yes. to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.